This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Tetyana Filevska and Olena Braichenko about a collection of essays, Ukraine, Food, and History, published in 2020. Tetyana Filevska is a creative director of the Ukrainian Institute, Ukraine's cultural diplomacy organization. She's an art manager, curator, and writer. Her background is in philosophy with experience in contemporary art and Ukrainian art history of the 20th century. She's the author of the books Kazimir Malevich, Kyiv Period, 1928-1930, Kazimir Malevich, Kyiv Aspect, and Dmytro Gorbachev, Sluchy. She worked in various art institutions in Ukraine. Tetyana is curating a public program of the Ukrainian Pavilion at the 59th Venice Biennale dedicated to decolonization. Olena Braichenko, for her PhD dissertation, researched ethnoculture in the Kyiv suburbs in the second half of the 20th, beginning of the 21st century. In 2016, Olena Braichenko co-founded Yizha Kultura, a scientific information project on important developments in the field of gastronomy that supports and promotes Ukrainian academics working in the field of food science. Olena Braichenko was the author and co-curator of the special program Kyrym about the cultural life of Crimean Tatars as part of the 6th International Festival in Kyiv, Knyzhkovy Arsenal. Hello, Tetyana. Hello, Olena. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello.
Your book contains a lot of beautiful pictures that demonstrate Ukrainian cuisine. And the first time I thought of your book was after I read one of the comments that I came across in a group for sponsors for the Uniting for Ukraine program. And one of the sponsors mentioned that all sponsors have to read something on Ukrainian food because it will help them to bond with those people whom they help. And of course, these conversations about food as a tool for bonding has been around for a long time and a lot has been written on it. But I think under the current circumstances, under the circumstances of Russia's war against Ukraine, the food as a tool for bonding acquired some new meanings.
So I would like to start our conversation with those inspirations behind the project and how the entire book is structured, because it was written back in 2020, although it's before the full-scale invasion. However, it's after the initial Russia's attack against Ukraine in 2014.
Well, I think I can start saying that maybe there were different books on food or about food from Ukraine or Ukrainian food, but I think this book is one of a kind because it combines both the history behind different regional cuisines, the cuisines of ethnic minorities and of indigenous people of Ukraine, and it combines the text written by scholars actually explaining deep cultural and anthropological ties between food and identity of those people all over Ukraine, and also having this practical side with recipes and very contemporary ways of interpreting these recipes, because, you know, we had contemporary Ukrainian chefs who worked with the traditional recipes and adjusting them to contemporary products, to contemporary types of cooking. So, I mean, this combination, I think, is quite unique. And I think this is something that we wanted to achieve with this publication, create this, let's say, unique presentation book, which looks as a very beautiful publication with nice images, as you already mentioned, with very important and meaningful text about Ukraine's history and culture connecting to the food, and also something that everyone can practice and everyone can experience, actually preparing Ukrainian food at their home, no matter where they live, in Australia, in Canada, or in Western Europe. And I think we were quite successful in achieving those goals, at least having the book translated into at least three European languages just a year after its first release says about this quite successful story.
Yes, indeed.
I agree with Sandy, but I want to describe my story about our photo and about our visual context, this book. As a publisher. Of course, as a publisher, I can say that our portfolio is pretty small, but still we pay special attention to our book project. Before the photo shoot, we, together with our designer, Olena Staranchuk, discussed the book's color, scheme, and layout. Then I spent almost maybe 1 or 2 months looking for the right textiles and ceramics for the photo shoot. Mm-hmm. And I'm really loves to speak about this story because the visual context includes Ukrainian dishes, national ceramics, modern Ukrainian decor, diner beer, and textile. And last but not least, the mastery of Ukrainian chefs.
So, as mentioned in the intro, very often Ukrainian cuisine was presented as something else. Can we say that Ukrainian cuisine didn't really exist for a long time on the culinary map of international gastronomy? And in what ways is Ukrainian cuisine unique?
Ukrainian cuisine has always been there and it's still there. But there was no promotion. Mm-hmm. We did not develop Ukrainian cuisine as a brand. As a result, when 7 years ago, my husband, Artem Braichenko, and I launched an independent project about Ukrainian food culture, Yezhokultura, I had to spend a lot of time and effort to convince the MasterChef community that the Ukrainian dishes are really exciting and original, for them to start working within the national cooking tradition. It was not the case in Ukraine for a number of reasons. Briefly, it's a result of our colonial Soviet past, which made us feel less worthy. Also, for many years, we could not shake off the feeling that Ukrainian dishes are part of the home cooking culture, and it's something accessible to almost everybody because anyone can cook. And finally, it's part of powerful myth created by the Soviet propaganda machine. It said the Ukrainian cuisine, language, and tradition belong exclusively to the rural culture, and as such, they should not be celebrated.
Well, I can only add that some of the Ukrainian dishes are quite known around the world, for example, the Kiev chicken or borscht or vareniki, the dumplings, but they were appropriated by other cultures or they were not identified as belonging to Ukrainian culture. So it happened only recently, or it has started happening only recently, that these dishes were kind of identified as Ukrainian. And one of the outcomes of this is that the Kiev chicken is finally Kiev chicken. So we even had the dish renamed, and I'm currently based in London, and I was fascinated to see how within a few weeks, you know, all the supermarkets in England changed this title on the cover of this dish, which is very popular here in England. So, I mean, it is happening, and these items, these dishes are being recognized as Ukrainian or having Ukrainian connection.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that the erasure, well, this low visibility of Ukrainian cuisine on the global map of gastronomy somehow contributed to the low visibility of Ukrainians as a nation on the global scale?
Of course, it is connected, and I'm sure it was to do with the colonial approach, well, imperial approach, let's say, colonizing approach of Russian Empire, which did everything for Ukraine to be invisible for the international audience. So, I mean, you know, we look at food, but we can see the same thing in cultural field, in artistic field, mm-hmm. you know. So artists and artworks from Ukraine were overlooked, were misidentified, were misinterpreted in international collections, and Ukrainian art as such in Ukrainian history was not a subject of international academia. So, I mean, with the food, it's the same. So it's the legacy of our colonial past that we were kind of overlooked within the empire. And of course, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2000, on the 24th of February, this has become obvious for everyone. One that this neo-colonial war of Russia can be stopped when we give the credit and we give the visibility to Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Olena. Would you like to add anything?
It's like a part of appropriation of culture, mm-hmm. Like is method of choice practiced by any empire. National culture is simplified, generalized, mm-hmm. and shaped into one narrative, which is then called Russian. There are many examples in art, in culture, and of course, with gastronomy too.
Mm-hmm. So at different time periods and due to a variety of historical and political circumstances, a number of Ukrainians relocated to various parts of the world. And while being far from their homeland, some of them didn't entirely abandon their food preferences and their culinary memory. Would you talk a little about how food can help preserve cultural heritage and an individual's memory of national and ethnic background? I know that your book contains a couple of interesting examples for individuals who kept their memory about their homeland via cooking, not only on individual level, but also in terms of some business enterprises.
I can start. I mean, I have my answer, but I'm sure Olena has her professional experience because I'm not a food specialist and not an anthropologist. But, you know, from my personal experience, food is not only about food. Food is much more. It's about being a community. It's about having legacy from your parents, your grandparents, and giving it to your children. So when we cook something, you know, we tell stories, we communicate, we have rituals, we have certain connection to each other, and that is meaningful. I mean, A few stories from my own personal experience. The area where my parents come from had a Czech community living nearby. And so in my family tradition, there are many dishes and there are many recipes that are connected to the Czech cuisine. And when I first went to outside of Ukraine, it was Slovak Republic, and then we traveled to Czech, I realized I know these names, I know these recipes, I know this taste, and it was because I was grown up being acquainted with that. That was part of my identity. So, and the same thing with any other type of food. It gives you the sense of belonging to a certain community. It gives you identity. It gives you identity and connection to the land where certain products grow. You know, it gives you connection to a certain landscape and certain climate where, you know, you can either grow certain tomatoes or they just don't grow, you know, like the watermelon or cherries. So, I mean, all of this has a meaning, like where your community lives, nearby the sea or nearby the river. It depends on what type of fish, for example, you eat or you don't eat, you know. So, I mean, that kind of combination of all these facts and all of these products and types of preparing food or like rituals around it, like, you know, are there any typical dishes that you cook for certain holidays? You know, are there types of food that women make or men make, or like the whole family is doing something to make it. I remember when I was a kid and we wouldn't prepare kutia, the traditional Christmas dish, you know, everyone has its own part of work. Like kids were supposed to crack nuts and cut them. Someone else were supposed, you know, like my grandfather was always the one to crush poppy seeds for this, you know. So every member of the family had its own duty, his own contribution into one dish. And that made, you know, made a connection and made this feeling of identity with a certain people, with certain land, with certain landscape. And of course, through this experience, everyday experience, life experience of every person, this connection is maintained and kept for generations.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And this is my kind of private view of this thing.
I forgot I had a special study on the subject, but it was before war. And sometime I really forgot some subject of some situation before war. It's like two different parts of my life, but it's true. My not big research focuses on the Ukrainian community in the USA, which was established after the Second World War. No, I'm pulling resources and efforts together for a small-scale study on the cooking traditions practiced overseas by Ukrainians who were forced to leave the country because of the war. Borscht, vareniki, holubtsi, syrniki, filled pastry, crepes, and other pancakes. These are the selected few recipes very popular with Ukrainians overseas. Why is that? First of all, because this is our form of identification. It's our language, and this is to show who we are. Secondly, it makes us feel at home, maybe. Not maybe, I'm sure. It's like it gives a feeling home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and as you were talking about the war and the experience that many Ukrainians are going through abroad, I was thinking about one of the Polish restaurants that I visited a couple of months ago, and there was a corner for Ukrainian culture in that Polish restaurant. And I thought that it's quite an interesting way of showing support, right? Not only through some business program, but also through food as well. That there is this island, Ukrainian island, within a Polish restaurant. But of course, we can also add to that this very strong solidarity on the political level as well between Poland and Ukraine. So while being a restaurant for Polish cuisine, they also show this support for Ukrainians as well in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're kind of turning, switching from the book and more into now our experience of food during the war. But I also can share that in the UK they don't have a lot of Ukrainian food accessible. There is some, but it's not that popular.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of Polish stores everywhere because there are like 1 million of Polish people living in the UK at the moment. So there are like plenty of stores everywhere. And I mean, I can get almost everything I'm used to in Ukraine from the Polish store. I mean, the very similar type of vegetables, milk products. I don't know, even mushrooms, you know, it's very curious how you can be like so distant and through a neighboring culture kind of have a touch of your own food culture. And it comforts, you know, being so traumatized by all of this war experience, food can comfort you. Food can give you a feeling of, you know, of calm, of something that's and reminds you, not alien to you, but reminds you of your home. And it's very important. And, you know, if we're coming back to our book and talking about the essence of Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian food, Ukrainian food as Ukrainian culture is not homogenic. I mean, it's not like about ethnic Ukrainians, whatever that means. It's about the multiple identities. It's about multi-ethnicity. Because we are speaking about, you know, the connections with Polish cuisine, with Crimean Tatar cuisine, Greek, Bulgarian, you know, many types of different. Jewish, of course, is a huge important chapter in our book. And I mean, you will find both recipes that kind of directly are related to that type of identity, but there are also interconnections, you know, something in between, something on the edge that are shared. Heritage and food for both cultures, let's say. So I mean, yeah, we can of course be supported in different ways, and food is one of them. And I mean, having this efficient connection and support from the neighboring culture is crucial in situations like that.
I wanted to follow up on a comment made by Tatiana regarding some specific spices, for instance, or specific foods that are typical of one region, while in different regions we have something different. Again, well, from one of my recent experiences, I came across a friend, right, and they are from Ukraine, but they didn't know what banush is. Because they are far away from that part of the world, that part of Ukraine. So maybe, Olena, you can talk a little bit about these specific products, specific vegetables, specific spices in different parts of Ukraine that you included in this book.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will try. But I can say that when I started researching Ukrainian cuisine, I set myself the goal of popularizing Ukrainian gastronomic culture, because it helps to develop the economy and individual mm-hmm. production of unique products. I have a big dream about some special shelves in the different shop, with grocery shop with Ukrainian products like brinza, shovdar, forest mushrooms, and another Ukrainian products like watermelon or Odessa's brand. And also maybe I can answer about unique Ukrainian cuisine, because I have very good borscht. For example, In this book, we have 6 different recipes of borscht. This recipe from different region, and also this recipe from different season, because Ukrainians still follow the oven seasonal rhythm, which is reflected in the dishes cooked in the spring, summer, and during the cold winter months. And really, borscht is a wonderful example. In the spring, we make green borscht with sorrel and spring herbs. In this book, we have green borscht. In the summer, it's not at all surprising that Ukrainians make meatless thin borscht, mm-hmm. and the dish is served cold. But with the coming of winter, borscht recipes include meat, and the dish become thick and nutritious. Popular spring recipes use fresh white cabbage, but winter borscht recipe include fermented or sauerkraut cabbage. And Ukrainian traditions still say that you don't waste food, and we know how to cook with fridge leftovers. We prefer home-cooked meals to commercial food products, and we are absolutely convinced that we must stock up on food. And the war has proved us right. We prefer homegrown vegetables and homegrown meat. Many Ukrainians grow their own vegetables, herbs, and keep farm animals. We also know how to use all animal parts, a cooking method known as from tail to nose, and it's a part of our cooking culture. We also have a complex foraging culture. It can be done both entertainment, and for food. Ukrainians frequently descend on forest in search of mushrooms. In Chernihiv, Sumy, Zhytomyr region, it will be berries and nuts. It's a part of our culture. We enjoy the process, and we have the know-how.
I'm glad you mentioned meatless borscht or vegetarian.
And also we have one recipe from Kherson region. It's borscht with fish.
Ah, interesting.
With baked fish. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely unique recipe. But it's very popular. If you cook this borscht, if you try, you mm-hmm. mm-hmm. fall in love. Mm-hmm.
Well, but I'm glad you mentioned fish borscht and meatless borscht. And it made me think about the ways in which food can also help us subvert some stereotypes. Because when we talk about borscht, generally people expect something with meat. And mm-hmm. at least from my experience, many were surprised with vegetarian borscht. Or for many, vegetarian borscht is not a real borscht. But as you pointed out, there are multiple recipes for borscht, and there are multiple variations of borscht depending on a season. So I thought that it could also be used to not just introduce a culture, but also to break some stereotypes. I would like to talk a little bit about culinary diplomacy. There was a fascinating chapter in your book, the book mentions that organizers of receptions have to be aware of the local peculiarities as well that help avoid international tensions and embarrassment. So would you talk about some of the events when food was part of Ukraine's international representation? I think this question probably is kind of outdated a little bit today, because I think that's all we do right now. We do use food in order to make Ukrainian culture visible and to reintegrate Ukrainian culture in the international context. But since your book was published in 2020, so I'm wondering what made you include this part, and what was the incentive, right, to create a separate chapter on this topic?
Well, I will begin, because that was our initiative, and you know, food is very important in diplomacy, and Ukrainian Institute is responsible for cultural diplomacy. So we wanted to meet these two kind of two directions in one, and we wanted to connect culture and food in this book, and diplomacy in this book, in this chapter. And we wanted to point out how important it is to know how food works and to be able to use food as the as well, I don't want to say an instrument, but as a means for diplomacy, you know, because it's crucial to have this in your protocol. And as you know, many the receptions that usually embassies have, they are representing national culinary traditions, national culinary approaches, and it's very important to, you know, also tell the story of the country and tell its actually potential, including economical potential, through food, through through products, through different types of cooking. And so we decided to emphasize the importance and the necessity of this instrument and this tool, and to give both our diplomats abroad and also, you know, just general public who want to work with food and to tell about Ukraine with food some more professional instruments and for some more information on how this can be used. Because, you know, when sometimes you cook something, you tell a story because of how you combine the product, how you combine the dishes. You know, you can emphasize a certain region. And just a few weeks ago, when the counter-offensive of Ukrainian army took place and liberated Kherson from Russian occupation, I saw dozens of photographs of diplomats who are staying in Ukraine in this difficult situation. I mean, international diplomats, ambassadors of different countries, with a piece of watermelon in their plate or in their hands, you know. So this piece of watermelon was a symbol, a political symbol, and that's how culinary diplomacy works.
Mm-hmm. So since we talked a little bit about culinary diplomacy, there was also a very popular, I would say, way of introducing Ukrainian cuisine to the international community via food tourism, via culinary tourism. Unfortunately, right now, this tourism is paused, but I do believe so it will be back on the market as soon as the war is over. And I'm wondering, well, and that was probably food tourism is one of the ways that still is kind of intriguing today with all the technologies available, because to try food, you have to travel to the specific place. Although when you just want to know more about culture, you can go online and you can get tons of information about countries, but specifically for food, you have to travel probably to if you want to try that authentic cooking. So I'm wondering what we will have any changes in terms of priorities for culinary tourism after the war. As for instance, Tatiana just pointed out this example with a watermelon. And I would personally love to go to Kherson just for this specific reason, because of Kherson watermelons.
And fish borscht.
Yes, and fish borscht, yes.
I wouldn't just talk about some specific place, but I think naturally many foreigners would want to come to Ukraine and explore the whole country. I'm also convinced that many Ukrainian women who will be coming back to Ukraine from overseas are going to insist that their new friends from Poland, from Germany, from USA, from Canada and other countries visit Ukraine. Unfortunately, our national food production infrastructure was gravely damaged by the Russian invasion.
Mm-hmm.
We know it and we see it. The damage includes bombed out farms. We specialized in craft cheese making, destroyed vineyards and orchards, landmines on arable land in Kherson, exactly. Decimated livestock, shelled out storerooms and restaurants, hijacked production equipment, and so much more. But even now if you come and visit Kyiv, Lviv, Chernihiv, or Odessa tomorrow or today, you will get a warm welcome and a table full of home-cooked food. Ukrainian restaurants have a really warm and welcoming atmosphere. It's not only about food or some specific dishes. It's also about atmosphere. Guests are always welcome in Ukrainian cafes and restaurants. We advise is to order some borscht. If you come in my country in the winter months, look for some fermented vegetables like cucumbers, tomatoes, aubergines, and cabbage. Also, try baked potatoes with meat or with meat and mushrooms or potato with mushrooms. Make sure you try out some curd pancakes or syrniki and baked crepes with cottage cheese. In the spring, go for open ground cucumber and tomatoes. They taste absolutely different. They are full of juice and flavor. Order some broth with river fish and a traditional Ukrainian beverage called uzvar. Make sure to taste different types of Ukrainian honey. For example, like Latvian honey, white and wild honey. Also, brace yourself for the abundance of meat dishes. We cook a lot with pork, lamb, chicken, and beef. Come to Ukrainian farmers market and look for fresh crispy salmon, herring, dried and smoked river fish, smoked meat, smoked pear, and special kolbas.
Well, yeah, you make us hungry.
I see you want to try.
Well, I would like to add that, you know, the mobility concerns in contemporary world actually touches everyone, you know. Not only people can travel, but also foods can travel and traditions can travel. So, I mean, despite the negative situation, I think there are more opportunities to eat Ukrainian food outside of Ukraine, thanks to the new restaurants, new cooks that are being invited to work in international restaurants, and also products. You know, I mean, I know of a couple of cases when Ukrainian restaurants have been open in major European capitals with Ukrainian chefs using genuine Ukrainian products, Ukrainian drinks, and sometimes using traditional recipes or making their own new kind of contemporary approaches to interpreting Ukrainian cuisine in the nowadays. So, I mean, of course, the best is at home, and you know, you can just pick it up from the garden and cook it immediately, and it would taste, you know, the authentic, genuine way. But I think there are also there should be also other ways to give a try to Ukrainian cuisine outside of Ukraine.
Can I say maybe one on this sentence? But we must know and not forget to say every time how many enterprises have suffered destruction due to Russian efforts. And our gastronomic heritage is under threat. It's absolutely true, and I can see it like researcher.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Olena and Tatiana. And thank you so much for this project that really
demonstrates how diverse in terms of culture Ukraine is and how many traditions Ukraine host. And I do believe that this book, specifically this book with beautiful, beautiful images, is very timely if we want to learn more about Ukraine, but also if we want to connect on a more profound way with those who had to leave the country, or if we want to connect on a more profound way with those who traveled to Ukraine, even for some volunteering initiatives. Well, thank you so much for this conversation, and thank you so much for the project.
Thank you. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you so much for your questions and the conversation.
Today I spoke with Tatiana Filevskaya and Olena Braichenko about a collection of essays, Ukraine, Food and History, published in 2020. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.